It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin is infamous for its drinking culture. While some see it as a badge of honor, it does come with health consequences. But long before old fashions and Wisconsin-made beers became our first choices at a happy hour, cocktails and beer were prescribed to us by health practitioners of various sorts, not bartenders. Alcohol has a long history of attempted medicinal use. Our next guest has a new book that traces back through the history of when beer was expected to treat the flu or brandy could cure malaria, or so people hoped. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the history of alcohol as medicine? Did you have something like this in your family where a little bit of blank was given you for an upset stomach or whatever, maybe when you were a kid even? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Camper English is a cocktails and spirits writer who has contributed to dozens of publications and runs his own bartending blog called Alcademics. He's the author of the new book, Doctors and Distillers, the remarkable medicinal history of beer, wine, spirits, and cocktails. Camper, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with the disclaimer. You say this in your book. You're here writing about the history of attempted uses of alcohol as medicine. You are not prescribing these various cures throughout the millennia.
Absolutely not. Talk to your doctor for medicinal issues. If you want a great drink, that's when you go to your bartender.
Excellent. Okay, now let's go back even to the beginning of alcohol, of beer and wine. It was used as kind of a health supplement because when you started to gather lots of people in civilization, we didn't know how to keep drinking water clean. Can you talk about some of those early uses of our beer and our wine?
Sure. There was a great attempts to avoid drinking water from surface water anyway, from rivers and lakes and streams and things like that, all of which today we know is contaminated from microbes. But back then it was just known to be unhealthy. And so the regular drink for people building the pyramids in Egypt, for example, would be beer. You know, it's made from grain, so it has calories and nutritional aspects to it and some minerals from the fermentation from the yeast. And it was also boiled in the process of making it, very importantly, to kill all those microbes from the water. And when it came to wine, you don't often need to add water in order to ferment wine into its final form. Although the Greeks and the Romans liked to water it down, and they considered full strength wine to be really uncivilized, like taking a swig out of the jug of whiskey today.
And if I'm building a pyramid, I would feel much safer knowing that the people also building the pyramid weren't really drunk. This is pretty low alcohol by volume beer we're talking about, right?
Absolutely. And the grains could be re-fermented a second time. And later in Victorian England and things like that, that was known as small beer and with probably only 2% ABV or something like that, where the original beer would be still only probably 5% or something. So it wasn't about creating a drunk and docile workforce at all. It was just a healthy, hydrating mineral water of its day.
And you trace from ancient times through medieval and beyond, oftentimes the practice of medicine such as it was, there was some overlap with the use of alcohol. What stands out to your mind when you think back on what you've written about, you know, how alcohol was used and overlapped with early medicine?
Well, one thing that was a real surprise for me to learn was that distilled alcohol, in particular, was created only in the context of medicine. There was no beverage use designated for it. It was the alchemist, they'd use distillation to try to create the philosopher's stone to turn lead into gold. And similarly, they would use distillation to preserve things like rose water or wormwood water or things like that with water-based medicine. And once the technology got good enough around the year 1200 or so, we see documentation of like, oh no, if you put wine in the still, this is the greatest medicine ever created. We're going to call it the water of life. It's so good. I always thought that was just a superlative term given to brandy because it's so delicious. But it turns out that was speaking to its revivifying and supposedly health-giving properties of distilled alcohol. And for the next 200 years, people just, that's all they could talk about was, this is really, truly the best medicine ever created. And only later do we find evidence of like, hey, probably don't drink so much medicine all at once because it's not going to create a healthy environment for you.
And this overlap, and I didn't really know about this, in the worlds of alchemy, through the worlds of beer brewing, a lot of things we know in medicine now and in chemistry came from those early alchemy experiments or, oh, hey, if we can control these microbes, we can make better beer. Well, there was some health benefit to figure out about those microbes, too. A lot of our modern health came from this.
Yeah, it's fascinating how the actual study of naturally carbonated water led to the understanding that air wasn't one gas, but was made up of several different elemental gases. And then that led to things like understanding individual elements, as well as later to anesthesia and using gases for other purposes. And then specifically with Louis Pasteur, the study of bacteria in wine and beer led to disproving spontaneous generation and directly to the germ theory of disease, one of the most important concepts in medicine, that there are these invisible microbes that spread disease. And it's not the miasma, the swamp gas that was thought to spread disease between person to person. It was actually going to be germs. And then that quickly led to things like anesthetics, antibiotics, and things that kill germ, again, using alcohol as a solution.
Talking to Camper English about his new book, Doctors and Distillers, The Remarkable Medicinal History of Beer, Wine, Spirits, and Cocktails. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Kathleen is with us in Eau Claire. Kathleen, hi.
Hello. Hello.
Hi. What do you want to tell us about, Kathleen?
Well, my family moved to northern Italy in the early 60s, and at the time, my youngest brother was a baby, was 6 months old. We lived in a hotel for probably 3 or 4 months while my parents were looking for an appropriate place to live. So we had dinner every night in the hotel dining room, in the hotel restaurant, and the baby would be fussy perhaps or crying or something every single night. The waiters would want to give the baby wine. Signora, signora, vino. But no, my mother was not about to do that.
Kathleen, thanks for the call. Vino for the Bambino. Camper, you don't need to go all the way to Italy. This happened in my family. I think a lot of people listening at some point in their family history, this happened. And even you talk about patent medicines and things like that. There was a product called gripe water for colicky babies. Kathleen's not alone here.
Yeah, there were actually several advertisements, particularly with Italian bitter liqueurs, where they would be recommended specifically for children. They would even contain iron for extra nutrition back when there were a lot of iron deficiencies. But I would say, you know, a spoonful of this alcoholic herbal medicine, maybe whip it up with an egg for your children every night. And it wasn't just for crying, but to infer to give some medicine to a daily dose for children. And it's amazing that it was advertised really specifically for that, knowing what we know today.
Thanks a lot for that call. Let's go to Steve now on the line in Stoughton. Steve, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. Three things that from my personal experience. One, my grandmother always said whiskey on the gums of a teething child. Mm-hmm. And you know, we did it and it worked. The other was they're finding a lot of value of flavonoids, and I like hoppy beer. So hops have a lot of flavonoids. So I continue to think that's a medicinal in use. And then finally, the hot toddy, which I swear by when you're not feeling good with a cold.
Steve, thanks a lot. Wow. Steve hit a lot of stuff in your book there. Camper, take it where you want to go.
Well, sure. In my family, it was you dip the pacifier in whiskey for the teething kid rather than put it directly on their gums. But for hops are not just a flavoring agent for beer, they're a preservative. And it turns out a lot of spices that we know today, they're all antimicrobial and would do the same thing. Wormwood, which we know from absinthe today, was used at one point just like hops is today. Into the beer. It both makes it taste more bitter, but it also would help it last much longer. And so there are a lot of different healing aspects prescribed to these herbs, but I think the hops is really more there and became more common for its preservative qualities overall. And the hot toddy in the era of the global flu epidemic of 1919, formerly known as the Spanish flu, the doctors would report like we couldn't really help we couldn't do anything for them but give them a little bit hot toddy to soothe them at the end. Although often we do find bitters in those hot toddies as well, which would have a lot of stomach soothing properties as well.
Thanks for the call, Steve. And Steve is calling from Stoughton, which made me want to talk to you about bitters because I didn't know this. The first big, I guess, English brand name of bitters was Stoughton bitters. And these were totally coming from a world of attempted health treatments, right?
Absolutely. It's Stoughton's bitters in particular, which were patented around the very end of the 1700s in England. Those make their way into the original cocktail, which was not the generic name for all mixed drinks, but a specific one that included a dash of medicine in it, Stoughton's bitters. And then that changed forms over the years and became used with other bitters in America. And it was actually a drink meant to soothe the stomach. And it came from the era before ice was common in cocktails. So it was a warm morning hangover drink to soothe the stomach with those medicinal bitters in there. And I can't think of anything less appealing that I would want in the morning.
We're talking to cocktails and spirits writer Camper English about his new book. It's called Doctors and Distillers, The Remarkable Medicinal History of Beer, Wine, Spirits, and Cocktails. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you heard claims about medicinal benefits of alcohol? Do you have that family story of using blank alcohol to cure blank condition? Do you have questions for our guest about his work? He goes back millennia up to the present day on this stuff. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Oh, have you ever drunk bitters on a particular bar, on a particular island off the coast of Wisconsin? We'll talk about that coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Camper English, cocktails and spirits writer. His new book is called Doctors and Distillers, The Remarkable Medicinal History of Beer, Wine, Spirits, and Cocktails. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Monique is with us in Stevens Point. Monique, hi.
Hi, nice to talk to you guys today.
Yeah, what did you want to bring up, Monique?
So my son brews mead, because my husband and I are local beekeepers, and so we provide him with the local organic honey to make mead. And when he started making it and I became such a huge fan, we did a little bit of research into it, and it turns out that mead was one of the original drinks given for people on their honeymoon for helping make babies.
Huh. All right. Monique, thanks for sharing that. A great family story, growing the making the honey and making the mead together. Camper, did you run across a mead-related health claims?
Yeah, there are a few throughout different eras in history, because honey, of course, predates sugar as a sweetener in Western Europe and in the United States. And honey in different drinkable forms, particularly with vinegars and things like that, was used for hydrating. And it was also used to cover the bitter flavor, a lot of more medicinal herbs. And so we find it used for a lot of different things over the eras, or just used as an ingredient in them. But even today, there are honey-based burn treatments, because honey is very much antibacterial. That's why it can last for so long without spoiling. And it can use to sort of cover or coat and seal up a wound and help recovery in some ways. And that's used in some over-the-counter burn treatments that you can find online.
Monique, thanks a lot for that call. Great story at 800-642-1234. Now, we were talking about bitters earlier. You referenced in the book Nelson's Hall and Bitters Club on Washington Island here in Wisconsin. People go there to do shots of bitters often. And part of that story happens during Prohibition, where because it was a medicinal use, they got to keep serving booze, even though most places couldn't. This was not uncommon. There was a lot of prescription alcohol out there?
Oh, absolutely. During Prohibition, the ways that people could drink were either by prescription, and then you could go to your pharmacy and just pick up a bottle of whiskey with your prescription, or medicines that had a base of alcohol, whether they were really trying to treat anything or not, could be purchased over the counter, likely without a prescription. So that's where we find things like bitters were fully available to purchase, and that gripe water that you mentioned earlier, these mother's helpers, so to speak, and things of that nature. It's also where we got Jake Leg, which was a horrible condition caused by people drinking an unsafe medicine, which caused a condition where the legs didn't work properly anymore. And that was during the same period with people choosing the medicinal alternatives as a way to get alcohol out of their medicine.
We'll go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Gail is with us in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Oh, this brings back a lot from the past. Oh, there's so many things. One of them that's really hard to find is Rock and Rye. It was a rye whiskey, and it had big chunks of citrus fruit in the bottle. And when you had a cold, you had that. And we used to have that when we were kids, believe it or not, when you really were congested. You just had a little glass of Rock and Rye.
Gail, thank you so much for sharing that. Now, I had Faygo Rock and Rye soda as a kid. This is something different. You write about the Rock and Rye that Gail's talking about, Camper.
I do. And actually, there was beyond Rock and Rye, there were Rock and Rum and Rock and Gin. And the rock refers to rock candy that was used to sweeten them. And there were also minty herbs in there, like whorehound was a notable herb, along with the citrus. And they were kind of generally feel-good medicines. What it really is, it's an old fashioned all mixed up together, and you could have that hot or cold, but they were to soothe conditions, particularly with the lungs and coughs and cold and consumption, as it was called, that we know it as tuberculosis today, to soothe those issues. And there are still some commercial rock and rye back on the market today.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Camper English about his new book, Doctors and Distillers, The Remarkable Medicinal History of Beer, Wine, Spirits, and Cocktails. Camper, a story just popped into my head from my life. I can't believe I didn't think of this while I was reading it. I'm 9 years old. I have a sore throat and a cough like I often did when I was a kid. My Polish grandparents are over. I'm coughing, clearing my throat. And my grandpa says what he needs is a hooker. And after the shocked silence, he explains, no, he didn't mean I needed a prostitute. A hooker was what they called. It was slang for a shot that you took to, you know, clear out your throat. Have you run across shots of alcohol for 9 year olds or otherwise as a sore throat cure?
Well, I got to admit, a lot of times before I give a talk or a Zoom interview, I might moisten my throat with a little bit of whiskey for just that reason.
I'll let my bosses know I do not do that on the air. I don't think the FCC allows that. Camper, I want to spend a little time on a really weird period of American health history. The patent medicines, many of which featured alcohol, plus heroin and cocaine and strychnine. Talk about some of the alcohol-laced patent medicines we used to have.
Well, sure. So early whiskey was the alcohol of America. And so we find a lot of whiskey-based medicines in particular. For a while, those were homemade remedies that you'd read about in like West Frontier medicine books. But then they became commercialized products that were heavily advertised and, you know, not always safe, often not safe. And often they didn't treat the things that they were advertised to cure. And so we find a lot of quinine, a lot of mercury and things like that in these patent medicines. Snake oil was a subcategory of patent medicine. And of course, that's now the name for fake medicines, but snake oil was a particular type of patent medicine supposedly made with rattlesnakes in America. And it may come from a Chinese tradition, but it wasn't really made with snakes. There was just a real shyster behind the famous snake oil, and he got busted later on. And after 1906, the Pure Food and Drug Law in America took care of actually a lot of the false advertisement in medicine, along with false additives in food and false additives and colorants and alcohol. So those were all wrapped up together in this era of the late 1800s of just garbage medicine, garbage alcohol, and garbage food. And that made its way eventually into what became the FDA.
You mentioned quinine. Now, this is one of the success stories of alcohol and medicine. Quinine, which is in that tonic water, does help with malaria. It's mixed with gin. Why did gin become part of this two-part cure?
Well, I think really the British soldiers were just putting gin in everything as a refreshment. The the quinine in the fizzy water comes from the belief that the fizzy water was, in fact, good for you as well. So it was a natural. They put quinine in everything, and it's still in a lot of Italian and French bitter liqueurs on the market today. We only think of it as being in tonic water, but it's in hundreds of products, alcoholic beverages, because of its history treating fevers and malaria in particular. The gin, I think, was really just along for the ride, but the juniper and gin had its own medicinal quantities that it was known for, particularly as a diuretic.
And having gone through the book, Camper, is there a cure you've tried yourself, if I may ask?
I didn't try anything that I haven't tried already, I would say, but I do probably really smart. Sort of believe in digestifs a little bit more than I used to, and understand that things like gentian that's in those bitters, you can throw a dash of that in with your fizzy water, and it not only tastes great, but it might help, you know, speed the digestion a little bit, make you feel a little bit less full, a little bit faster than you did.
Camper, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Camper English, cocktails and spirits writer and speaker. He was with us today to talk about his new book. It's called Doctors and Distillers, The Remarkable Medicinal History of Beer, Wine, Spirits, and Cocktails. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now think about the saying, find out what you're made of. Usually that's about character, values, toughness, more than, you know, the nuts and bolts of the human body. But what was the last time you actually got curious about what we are actually made of? Not just the hair and skin and organs and stuff, but the small stuff, the atoms. How about how the food we eat becomes us? In his new book, our next guest tackles these and other ultimate questions of life, the universe, and everything. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are these things you are curious about, or were you as a kid? Do you have a question about what we're made of, what we're not made of, how we got to be what we are? Our next guest goes back to the Big Bang to start things off. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Dan Levitt writes and produces science and history documentaries. His new book is called What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much. I'm so happy to be here.
I got to ask about the journey here, because if I thought of some of the starting questions you did, I might, you know, go online for a couple few minutes and then be done with it. Instead, you literally go from Big Bang to how we, you know, how our cells turn food into energy, plus the science behind it. What kicked off this journey?
You know, it started with a question. When my teenage daughter was thinking of becoming a vegetarian, I naturally was wondering what she would have to eat in order to remain healthy. And when I started thinking about it, I actually realized I have no idea what our bodies were made of. And a little bit more thinking, and I realized I actually don't even know where that stuff, whatever it was, came from. And then it kind of hit me, which was, wow, everything that's in our bodies now, every single particle, actually started 13.8 billion years ago at the Big Bang. And so that kicked off a whole lot of Googling and questioning. And, you know, what I discovered is not just that it's an amazing journey from there to here, but also the fact that we are made of particles from the Big Bang, and we can actually reconstruct that journey and look back and figure out how we got here. That's also just amazing. So how scientists discovered it also was something that just absolutely fascinated me.
I'm gonna go to some of the things that fascinated me that I learned in your book. So you mentioned some of our material, or all of it, originated 13.8 billion years ago. The bits of us that are hydrogen, which is a fair amount of us, that's the original material. Those are the same atoms as when the universe started.
That's it. And that's 10% of your body. But all the other atoms, which are different elements like oxygen and carbon and so on, their constituents, the electrons and the protons that they're made of, also came right out of the Big Bang.
But they needed a little work, right? So those bigger atoms, the carbons and things like that, how did they end up existing in the universe, first of all, much less being part of us?
Yeah, so once the Big Bang happened, there was a huge amount of oxygen that went out in massive clouds into the expanding universe. A large collections of those condensed into stars. And once that hydrogen was at higher and higher pressures, which gravity contracted into this higher and higher pressures and temperatures, it fused helium, and that liberated energy. And that, and when it liberated energy and the star got hotter, then it was able to make heavier elements with more protons in the nucleus. Every element has an additional proton compared to the one before it on the periodic table. So as stars created heavier elements and it released more energy, that allowed the stars to make even heavier elements until the element iron, which has 40 protons in its nucleus. After that, the rest of the elements in the universe and in our body were made by the most powerful explosions in the universe, which were supernovas, the massive explosions of stars.
Okay, and that's all amazing. But then here's the really baffling thing to me. Most of me is nothing. There's gaps among the atoms, the molecules between them. There's more nothing than something in a human body.
Yeah, I really have a hard time getting my head around it as well. But if you look at an atom, like just a hydrogen atom, 99% of it is empty space. So if you took the nucleus and you blew it up so that it was the size of a tennis ball, the electrons are worrying a mile away. There's a huge amount of empty space within our body, so much so that some of the tiniest particles that we know of, like, called neutrinos, they can just shoot right through us.
We are talking about what we're made of with author Dan Levitt. His new book is What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. You can join in with your questions, your experiences in studying these things, maybe at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, this is a good topic. It's something I've internalized. I've read recently that men, male Americans at least, part of a research study, are deficient in magnesium. And I read that the magnesium chemical or nutrient affects how our body, how the synergy of the energy affects, that magnesium affects the relationship between the atoms in our body, and the deficiency is a negative thing, and we need to eat more magnesium. Is that enough of a question?
Jeff, I got you. If you don't mind, Jeff, I'm going to take us on a detour into the 19th century, Dan, where scientists were really tackling questions of what do we need to eat? What happens if we eat these things? What happens if we don't eat these other things? Can you talk about the quest to narrow that down?
Yeah, well, that's fun because, in the 19th century, we didn't know that we do need some minerals like magnesium. And you might wonder how they ever figured it out. And the way they figured it out, one way they figured it out, was they knew that our food has proteins, fats, carbohydrates in them. And so they made artificial food with those constituents and fed them to animals like laboratory rats, and they discovered that they got sick. And so by a process of deduction, they were able to figure out that, oops, you know, we need chlorine, we need magnesium, we need potassium, we need sulfur. There are certain mineral and iron we need to get from plants in addition to the other things that we already knew about.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Another component we need, and I want to go to this one because a lot of these were discovered at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, vitamins. And I want to get it. You share the story of scurvy, which I thought I knew, right? Sailors got scurvy. They didn't eat oranges. They didn't get enough vitamin C in their diet. Easy peasy. Except people figured this out and then forgot about it again and again. Can you talk about why it was so hard to connect the dots between this horrific condition that killed thousands of sailors and just eating some oranges?
Yeah, it's baffling when you look at the face of it. Scurvy is a terrible disease, and the British Navy suffered dreadfully from it. And there was a while when ship's captains knew that if they had fresh vegetables, and particularly if they had lemons or oranges, and fed them to their sailors, they wouldn't suffer from it. But I think people got very complacent about it. And the thing that was the real killer was, at the time, no one had the concept of a vitamin. A vitamin is a weird thing. You know that if you eat something, you'll get sick from it. But who would think that if you don't eat a tiny bit of something that you've never heard of, that'll also make you sick? And at the time, their theories of disease were about were really the Greek theories of the humors, that all the diseases they thought were created by these four humors in the body that were in imbalance. And so they didn't have the concept of a vitamin. And so it took a long, long time for them, for scientists to even get that idea in their heads. And in the meantime, the millions and millions of British sailors, among many, many other people, died from it.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So this is a bit of a tangent, and I apologize in advance. But I read a lot of Terry Pratchett's novels, and in a couple of the Discworld books, he includes a little song that, knowing Terry, I'm not sure how much of it is, you know, taken from actual old songs and how much of it is him. But it's iron enough to make a nail, lime enough to paint a wall, water enough to drown a dog. And it goes on like that for a little bit. And it's just talking about all the things that it takes to make a man. And I just thought it's kind of interesting that, you know, you go back all these hundreds, if not thousands of years, and people have you tried to figure out, like, okay, but what makes us alive?
I gotcha, Michael. Thanks a lot. You kind of break down how much of product element X it takes to make a human, as that song tried to do, Dan.
Yeah, I love that. So if you weigh 150 pounds, you have a carbon enough to make 25 pounds of charcoal. You've got enough salt in your body to fill a salt shaker. You have enough chlorine to disinfect a couple backyard swimming pools, and enough iron, your caller was exactly right, to make a 3-inch nail. And furthermore, he was right, because your body is over 50% water.
Thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to science and history documentarian Dan Levitt about his new book. It's called What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about anything we've been talking about his journey to learn the history of the stuff we're made of, the atoms and molecules and nutrients and how they get there? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Dan Levitt about his new book. It's called What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Dan, before we go back to our callers, a big part of your book is about the scientists who made the discoveries you're looking at and the workings of science. And an amazing theme seems to be scientists propose this idea. Everybody dismisses it as ridiculous, but then some of them say, okay, I'm going to try to disprove it. And they can't disprove it, and it becomes accepted science. What did you learn just about the way scientific progress works?
You know, I always thought that that science is just follow the evidence. But when I was researching all of these amazing discoveries, I discovered that at the time that they were first presented, so many of them, the vast preponderance of them that I looked at in my book, were just completely dismissed when they were initially presented, or the scientists treated them with complete scorn. And so I discovered that there were six particular reasons that made whole communities of scientists very skeptical of radical new discoveries, not incremental ones, but radical ones. You know, one of them, I gave them nicknames, right? One of them is the too weird to be true bias. When scientists first proposed that the universe was not static, but was expanding, I mean, huh? No way, right? I mean, it's just, it's crazy. When scientists first proposed that organic molecules, which are the molecules that our bodies are made of, which are not rock, but they're longer chains of molecules could exist in space, people were completely skeptical. And then often people had faith in the world's greatest experts and didn't always examine really carefully the assumptions that those experts made. And so, you know, I learned that these kinds of cognitive biases in the short term, not in the long term, but in the short term, can really, really retard science, because scientists, they're just not very different from any of us. We all have unconscious assumptions that often we don't bring to the fore. And when we do, sometimes we're just wrong.
Let's go back to our callers now. Chet is with us in Maquonago. Chet, hi.
Hello, it's Chet. Yeah, nice to hear from you. I'm totally relating to what you're saying about the everything you eat makes you. I teach a botany class to a bunch of fifth graders, and I'll start the day saying, first I'll say I'll show my thumbnail. So you see this thumbnail? That's a pork chop I had about a week ago. You know, but the funnest thing I like to do, and I think this relates to what you're saying, is I'd like to start the class off also with a question. I would tell them, I says, well, everything you eat comes from the soil. And they would often argue with me, no, what if you were raised in a cannibal family, or what about fish and all this other stuff they would ask me. But the thought that everything you eat comes from the soil was, it seemed kind of radical too, but it always ends up there. And then it always seems to end with us saying, well, who makes the soil for us, you know? And it's the trees, and that's how I get into the botany end of it. But the trees and the plants make soil for us so we can grow food, so that we can make fingernails. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. Chet, thanks a lot for the call. And Dan, you spend some time on photosynthesis and the mystery of how plants convert energy from the, or was a mystery of how plants convert energy from the sun, and that does all the things that Chet just said.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we really are creatures of plants, and it all goes back to photosynthesis. You know, when I was in school, I probably learned about photosynthesis, but I paid it no mind. Now I think it's the most amazing reaction ever in the world. It was invented by bacteria several billion years ago. Now, it's in plants. And here's what it is. You take carbon dioxide from the air, you take hydrogen from water, and you take energy from the sun, and you make sugar out of it. And then from that sugar, you can make other organic compounds. So this is one of the many mind-blowing things that I learned in the book, is that 93% of your mass actually comes from photosynthesis. 83% of your mass was once just carbon dioxide floating in the air, and another 10% was hydrogen that was in the water. So, you know, we really are completely products, in a sense, of both plants and photosynthesis.
Thanks for that call, Chet. We're talking to Dan Levitt about his new book, What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. Staying with the mind-blowing theme, Dan, part of that process that took a while to figure out also was how cells convert stuff to energy, and just the sheer rate of what's going on, the chemical reactions in a cell. Can you give us a sense of the scale, how quickly our cells are creating energy for us?
So there's an energy currency in our cells called ATP. And your average cell consumes and therefore has to remake 10 to 100 million of them every single second. And the way it does that is unbelievable. This was another incredible thing that I learned, which is they're actually, it's done in a little chemical factory in your cell called a mitochondria. The mitochondria has little electric currents inside, made not of electrons, but of protons. Again, protons from the Big Bang. And those protons drive these nanomachines, these unbelievable nanomachines called ATP synthase. And why I call them machines is that they've got a rotor that spins at up to 300 revolutions per second. And then there's another piece that creates the ATP, and it's connected, interlinked to another piece that kicks the ATP off into the cell. It's a very beautiful, sophisticated machine, and it kind of looks almost waterwheelish, like something that Leonardo da Vinci would create. And that creates all of the energy in your body. Fun thing about that is, if you were to take all the mitochondria in your body that create your energy and lay them out flat, they would cover 2 basketball courts. There are that many of them.
Wow.
And they create as much energy in your body as a 100-watt light bulb.
In the book, you tackle a lot of answered questions, things that we figured out. Well, people smarter than me figured out over the decades. What to you are a couple of the biggest still unanswered questions about what makes us what and who we are?
Well, the origin of life is a topic, is a subject that we have a lot of very good theories about, but that one, there's still a lot of unanswered questions. How exactly did the first cell form? And then the big one that I don't tackle in my book is consciousness. You know, I do talk a lot about how the molecules in our cells, 100 trillion molecules in each of our 30 trillion cells creates life. And we know a tremendous amount about that. But then how all the nerve cells in our brain create consciousness, that's still one of the biggest mysteries in science.
Having gone through this process and written this book, do you look at your food differently now?
Yes. There's a wonderful quote that one scientist said is, when I see people walking down the street, essentially I'm paraphrasing, I see plants rearranged.
Do you feel different as a human being, as a holder of these 13 billion year old atoms?
You know, I do, because you know, I learned that even the simplest cell is unbelievably complex and worthy of respect. And we are made of 30 trillion cells. You know, I mentioned that each one has 100 trillion atoms. If they were each the width, the thickness of a dollar bill, and you were to stack them up, they would go up to the moon and back almost 30 times. So it's almost impossible for us to appreciate how truly sophisticated we are. Our cells are filled with all kinds of unbelievable sophisticated mechanisms that were built by, again, from particles that came down to Earth willy-nilly, ultimately from the Big Bang.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Dan Levitt. He's a documentarian who produces films about science and history. We talked to him about his new book. It's called What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.